Hello and welcome to our program, 10 Lessons Learned, where we talk to interesting people from all over the world about their interesting experiences and the lessons they have learned. My name is Siebe van der Zee, and I'm your host. I'm based in Phoenix, Arizona, in the beautiful Grand Canyon State, where I'm also known as the Dutchman in the desert. Our guest today is Melissa Hahn. Melissa is an author and an intercultural professional who helps people collaborate, adapt, and thrive across cultures. She works independently as a trainer, coach, and as a consultant. She teaches intercultural communication at American University, and she is on the leadership team of the Global Dexterity Certification. Melissa earned a master's degree in intercultural relations from the University of the Pacific in California. She has lived abroad in Poland, and she has extensive professional background that spans international relations, teaching English as a second language, and in global mobility and corporate relocation. Melissa believes that intercultural skills are for everyone because we all come from different cultures and we all need to figure out how to live, work, and connect with people who have different backgrounds and life experiences from ours. Both through her children's book named Luminarias, Light the Way, I love the title, and her brand new book, Forging Bonds in a Global Workforce, published by McGraw-Hill, Melissa aims to show how practical, doable, and fun this process of learning intercultural skills can be for all people at all ages. You can learn more about Melissa Hahn on our website, 10lessonslearned.com. Hello, Melissa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Siebe. It's great to be here.
I appreciate it. And you have such a fascinating international, global background. But maybe to start, where is your passion for intercultural relations coming from?
This is a really good question, and I don't know if I can pinpoint the precise origin, but I think there are two components. One is that as I grew up in Arizona, where you are currently located, and it felt a little bit removed from some of the world history and some of the cultures that I was really curious about. So I just always wanted to get out there. I wanted to see the world and I wanted to connect with the world. And the more I had those experiences, the more excited I was and the more I wanted to help other people. But at the same time, as I had those experiences, I realized that I hadn't come from nowhere. I'd come from what was actually a very interesting place. And that, in fact, there were many cultures in my home state of Arizona that I had grown up around that were not familiar to other people. And so I started to have a renewed appreciation for the diversity and really the vibrant cultural environment that I was familiar with from my childhood. And so there was this reciprocal process where I wanted to see the world away from home. And as I did that, I became interested in the world I had come from. And I started acting like a bridge. And the more that I did that, the more I enjoyed it, the more I wanted to help other people do that. But just started perpetuating itself of its own accord.
Wow. It all, let's say, led to your brand new book, Forging Bonds in a Global Workforce. Tell us a little bit more about this book. It's brand new, and I'm very curious to read it.
Oh, thank you, Siebe. It is brand new. Forging Bonds in a Global Workforce is co-authored by Andy Malinsky and published by McGraw-Hill. And we are trying to offer a new approach to crossing cultures. Now, people who are interested in global work and intercultural relations might be familiar with some of the books that are already out there. What we're wanting to do is build on what they've already accomplished. We're at a point, Andy and I think, where we're not really needing so much to identify all the ways that we're different. Of course, differences are interesting and they're a source of appreciation for where the other person comes from. But the real challenge, we think, in this era of virtual work and increased loneliness and political fragmentation, all these things that are pulling us apart, we think it's time to really focus on building actual relationships with real people rather than just trying to enumerate all of the abstract academic complexities. That's what our book tries to do. We try to package our advice and our frameworks and our insights in the form of easy-to-use approaches and tips and real-world stories so that people have a starting place. We think a lot of people could be a lot better at crossing cultures if they just had somebody show them how, and that's what we're trying to do.
Does it go beyond the basic do's and don'ts?
Oh, definitely. The lists of do's and don'ts are very popular on social media. If you've ever looked up a quick list before you go somewhere, you know how they can be helpful. But unfortunately, the chances are good that you're going to meet somebody who doesn't exactly fit that list. What we want to do is offer strategies and methods and approaches for how you can get the lay of the land when you first meet another person, and that you don't have to rely on memorizing those lists of do's and don'ts, because you have strategies and things you yourself can try in the moment, whether that person from the other culture meets your expectations about their culture or not, because you really never know how somebody is going to be when you meet them for the first time.
It happens that we stereotype other cultures, other countries, and we say, the Japanese are like this, the Germans are like that, the Brazilians, etc. But when you meet individuals from those countries, they don't necessarily fit that very generic type of framework, right? And each individual can be different from the national culture.
Definitely. And, I think that's especially true in global work and in an era where so many people are studying abroad, or they might have relatives in multiple countries. And so you never really know what their own cultural inspiration points are going to be. So one of the things we try to help people do in the book is to go beyond stereotyping and try out something we call prototyping, where it still helps to have a guess. You don't want to just assume every person is going to be so different that they're unknowable, because that will be overwhelming too. But if you can have a guess, that's okay. What you want to do is test that guess when you meet a person for the first time and see if they actually are what you expected. And if not, you want to try to adjust and get to know the real version of them, rather than trying to squish them into the stereotype that you're bringing to the table.
Great point. I look forward to your 10 lessons. But before we get there, let me ask you another question. Are there any lessons in your life, in your career, that you have learned that you wish you would have known when you were much younger?
One that comes to mind, and I say this to my students as well, when I work with graduate students at the university, I really wish I had just let people know that I wanted their advice and that I could use their help. I think, especially as a young professional, I think people feel this way today. There's a lot of pressure to show that you are really well organized and you're completely on track and you are competent and you've got it all together. And those are really important signals if you want people to take you seriously. But sometimes I think we can be so focused on showing other people that we are completely self-contained and we've got it all together, that we don't actually create a space for them to share their insights and advice with us. And I think if I had just opened the door a little crack and let people help me, I probably would have had an easier time. And I also might have then opened the door to other opportunities, because they would have known that I was ready and wanting that support, rather than trying to just show them I had everything down perfectly.
It is so powerful to have a mentor, to have someone that has your interest in mind. And at the same time, I don't know if that makes any sense, but the younger we are as people, the smarter we are. When I was 19, 20 years old, I was much smarter than when I was today. So I don't need someone to tell me what to do. You know what I mean, right?
And definitely.
For many people, that's something that we experience. But then, like you say, you come to the point where you say, wow, I wish I would have had someone, or I wish I would have listened to the people that were out there and were willing to help you. But again, like in my case, I was much smarter than they were. Not really.
I think that's a starting place for this book as well, Zibe, is that we want to give people permission to not have all the answers. Because if you think you have to have all the answers, it's very hard to get started. You can search for answers and try to prepare forever, but oftentimes our work is happening now. And we want to help people accept the fact at some level they can't fundamentally know everything there is to know about the other culture. We have to try to somehow be in a position where we can ask for help.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a look at your 10 lessons. Lesson number one, cultural competence isn't memorizing details about another culture. It's building relationships with individuals from those cultures. What are your thoughts on that?
One of the best things that one of my professors and my mentors ever said to me was that there's a huge difference between learning about culture and actually doing culture. And that if you are studying about culture, you're acquiring knowledge for your brain. That's really powerful. It's great to have this information about other cultures, because that alone can help us shift our perspective. But if you think about things too much and you don't get around to actually engaging, you don't have a chance to really test that knowledge. When we're talking about cultures, the real kind of proof is whether you can engage with another human being. I think that a lot of our trainings that we see, a lot of the material that's out there is really trying to prepare people for the moment of encounter. But what I want to encourage people to do is to have that moment of encounter. Because until you actually interact, until you actually try to do something, whether it's baking a cake or riding a bike, you can't actually have the learning that you're waiting for. So I think the real power is in having that moment of connection. Then you can learn something. Then you can move forward together.
It's a great point. And it makes me think about how people travel to certain countries, maybe to go on vacation or for a short trip to attend a conference. That doesn't mean they have enough time to really learn the culture. And they may have been to that particular country or city a number of times and say, oh yeah, I've been there. I've been to Rome a number of times. Well, does that mean you understand the Italian culture? In my experience, no, because back to your point, it takes time to build those relationships. I think there is a difference. People who have lived and worked in a country other than their, let's say, native country, compared to people who have gone on a vacation to a country, right? I think that's what you're talking about as well, to have that time to learn.
Yeah, there's the time and there's the commitment, but there's also the intuition that you develop.
We will continue with lesson number two. You're not getting a cultural report card. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this ties in with lesson number one. I think oftentimes when we see a cultural training or the way somebody is approaching their culture crossing experience, the reason they're trying to learn all this information and have all of the do's and don'ts is that they're trying to avoid mistakes. And they're trying to avoid mistakes because they want to make a good impression on the other party. But in lesson number two, I want to share that we're actually not being graded. When we're interacting with another person, we are getting to know that person. We're not just performing their culture in a kind of abstract, decontextualized way. We're often working on a project where we have specific goals. And what we need to do is focus less on, am I doing the other culture right? And we need to focus on how can I use my cultural knowledge to navigate the situation so that I can work with this particular person in this particular time and place on these particular goals. If you think about how there's a reason for you being in the situation, there's also a reason for that other person being in that situation. If they are totally focused on just performing your culture, it's going to get in the way of what you're trying to accomplish together. So I think about it less as I'm being evaluated and more about we are engaged in this moment together and how can we actually make the most of this moment? How can we do this together? It's something you're co-creating in real time as opposed to something you're just performing.
Now, not to disagree, but if I think about companies that are operating in multiple countries and they have a certain way of managing their people, their teams, and they go to another country and they say, well, this is how we do it in our country, whichever our country is, but let's say United States. And in your country, whatever that country is, but let's say Japan, we want you to do the way we do it. And there's some resistance and perhaps people say, well, that person from the other country doesn't understand how we do things in our country. So in that sense, is there perhaps a report card to say, well, those people don't know about our culture?
I do think that you have to demonstrate an effort to meet the other culture where it is. But sometimes we get focused on this idea that we are just being evaluated on our cultural skill, and that's it. I think that the cultural skills are tools that we can use for what really matters, which is in the case of your example, managing the other party. If I were to go to Japan and everybody else was Japanese and I was in a traditional Japanese company, then I would have to adapt much more than if I was working on, say, a startup and one of the employees on the startup happened to be Japanese and they were younger than me and they had grown up living all over the world. So the degree to which I would need to adapt specifically to their culture would shift. What we don't want to do is think that purely acting as if we're more local than the locals is the goal. You want to try to demonstrate an appreciation for the local culture while somehow figuring out what it is you're supposed to do there. I would not go in and say, I don't have to adapt because I'm not going to perform your culture. But what I also wouldn't do is set this sort of perfectionistic mindset bar so high that I get overwhelmed before I can even begin. In the case of your example, I would probably look for somebody that could serve as a cultural mentor. And I would say, I really want to be successful in this situation. What are two or three things I should know? And then I would focus on those rather than just trying to ace the culture as a whole, because that's too much for most people to try to take on. It's too much information to keep track of.
That's a great lesson for people to learn and implement, because you cannot pretend you're an expert on a country that you don't really know well, and to find someone from that country who can guide you, who can understand, and perhaps someone who understands both, of course, their own culture, but then also the culture where, let's say, the other person is coming from, to understand those challenges. I think that's extremely helpful. Moving along, lesson number three, don't judge cultural experiences by whether you like them. Judge them by whether they make you grow. Sounds so great.
You're probably seeing a pattern now with me, Zibe, that I'm really interested in the way that we approach culture in our own minds, because our cultural crossing experiences are not just going to succeed or fail based on how we behave. It also has to do with how we think about them. Yeah. So one of the reasons in the previous example that I don't want to be too perfectionistic is that it can prevent us from doing what I propose in this lesson, which is to have a growth mindset. But we also don't want to get fixated on whether we like something. I remember when I went to Poland, it was difficult from the moment my husband and I stepped off the train. The train was several hours late. It arrived in the middle of the night. It was raining. This was before smartphones. We had no way to figure out where we were going. We had no way to get money for the taxi because the ATMs in that area weren't available. And from the very moment we arrived, it felt hard. This sort of overwhelming joy was not our emotional experience. We felt the culture shock immediately. And if we had decided that we had to like it, otherwise it was a failure, we would have been really frustrated. So we decided to reframe our goal. Rather than saying, do we like it? Is it a good place? We said, what can we learn from it? Why are we here? We were there for a reason. I was pursuing my master's degree. We said, what can we learn? What can we see? What can we experience? What can we go explore that we've never heard of before, we've never done before, or we never could do at home in Phoenix? And so we set this kind of scavenger hunt goal for ourselves. We wanted to be as curious as possible. And I think when you're curious, the world opens up to you. There's all kinds of possibilities because now you're receptive to information. That's going to be a lot more productive than just trying to grin and bear it and make yourself like something that maybe you're not in a place that you can like yet. And the interesting thing was the more that we did, the more we actually did like it. So when liking it wasn't this all-consuming goal, it actually just appeared on its own, because now we had found lots of our own avenues to feeling more comfortable and more at home in our new environment.
Are you making some great points? And I can see that for so many people interacting in a culture, in a country different than their own, that I think it's part of human nature that we are very quick to put labels and say, oh, I don't like that. And I don't. But if you open your mind and say, well, let me find out, let me learn. And I mean, I can think of many experiences in my life as well. Wow, that's so different. I don't think I like it. But then when you think about it, my example is when I lived in South America, and it was standard for restaurants to open not before 9 o'clock in the evening. Well, around 6, 7 o'clock, I get a little hungry. But as I told myself, I cannot change this country. And then I realized that after dinner, the people in that country, Uruguay, they go out in the streets, they socialized, and yes, they take a siesta, which I didn't. But what a wonderful way to interact. And when I look back, I would say, wow, I wish everybody would live life like that. And so indeed, you learn from it. And as you say, you grow from it, because it's a different experience than the way you were raised and you grew up in your own country and culture. But with those experiences, it's like, wow, it broadens your horizon.
And the more you do it, the more you're prepared to do it the next time. So Zibe, you were in Uruguay, you had this experience. Now you can use those same culture crossing curiosity muscle in your time in Arizona. It was the same for me. The more you allow yourself to be curious, I think the more prepared to be curious you are in the next environment that you find yourself in.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier the term culture shock. And that's like, oh my gosh, this is so different from what I was used to in my own country. But to overcome culture shock and to have an open mind and say, hey, like you said with your husband, how can I learn from this? And how can we, obviously you were there for a purpose, but how can we gain more experience in that particular country and culture? Yeah, makes good sense. Lesson number four. Oh, I like this one. There are no wasted experiences. Believe me, no wasted experiences. I'm sure you have a good thought behind that.
Okay, so this idea that there are no wasted experiences is rooted in my early adulthood, my first professional years, but it also is something that I've only fully appreciated more recently. And when I graduated from college, it was the aftermath of September 11th and the dot-com bust, and there wasn't a huge demand for people who had studied Russian and Central and Eastern Europe. And I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do, but in the meantime, I had to have a job. And there was an opening in the summer at the YMCA to be a swimming instructor and a swim coach. And I had swum for a long time competitively, and I thought, okay, I guess I'll do this for the time being. Well, what was really interesting is that experience teaching people how to swim, which either meant keeping the attention of five-year-olds, which was a group that I coached, or helping people let go of their fears and really step into the pool for the first time in their lives. All of those things are really similar to what it's like to help people as a cross-cultural trainer and coach. I really got a sense for how important it was to meet people where they were and to really listen to them and their needs and their fears and their sources of motivation. I had a sense for how I could give feedback more effectively. You have to communicate in a certain way if you're going to try to help somebody understand how they should move their body in the water, and it's the same for crossing cultures. I also had to figure out how I could be patient with their own progress. Sometimes we want, as cultural trainers, we want people to make progress now. And it's the same thing with swimming, but I had to let it play out. And another thing I had to learn was how to scaffold my instruction, which piece of information should come first, and then how can I help them build on that? So at the time when I was doing this, I was really disappointed. I couldn't believe I had graduated and I had this degree and I was just in this pool with a bunch of kids. But really what I was doing was laying the foundation for the work that I am doing today. And I never would have predicted that more than 20 years ago. But now that I see that, I want to share that with other people, because I think we all end up in moments that we didn't expect to be in. And if we can pull something from that experience, whether it's an expat experience or a job that maybe wasn't quite the right fit, if we can see the value in that and we can bring the value into our future chapters, then really it wasn't a waste or even a disappointment. It was something that really can add a lot to the overall quality of our life.
Do you see yourself as an optimist, no matter what?
It's interesting. I don't feel particularly optimistic. Something I picked up from living in Poland and Central and Eastern Europe is a skepticism about being overly sunny and optimistic. That's a very American kind of cultural value. And I feel that after living in Poland, I feel a bit more skeptical about that. But it's more of a certainty and a resolve that even, it's not that I feel optimistic that things will always work out. It's that I think they won't work out and we can get through them anyway. So it's a realistic, it's not negative, but I don't think it's quite optimism either.
Yeah, there. I had to think of a quote by a famous Dutch soccer player many, many years ago. And well, in English, it says every disadvantage has an advantage. And again, as a soccer player, that means you're losing the game or you didn't score the goal. But there is something positive about that. And I understand that's why I asked. You don't have to be an eternal optimist. You have to be a realist, perhaps. And like you said, other countries are, in that sense, maybe less excited than people in the United States. Even the word excited seems to fit in the US. But it is, okay, let's look at the positives and yes, you're dealing with negatives, but you will get over it. You will move on. And I think that's I like what you're saying as far as there are no wasted experiences. You'll learn no matter what. And sometimes it's tough, but the experience could be worthwhile.
Definitely. All right.
Yeah. Well, let's take a look at lesson number five. Think about the messages that you are sending and whether they facilitate trust. Now, trust is a key element in building relationships, right?
It is. And researchers have found that the kind of constant elements that we're looking for when we meet a new person or getting to know them are kind of two factors. One, is this person likable? Do I want to spend time around them? And the other is competence. Are they good at what they do? Now, the difficulty is that when we're crossing cultures, the way that we signal these things and the way that we interpret those signals can be really different. So what I might signal to an American about I'm a nice person and I'm going to be good to work with might be different than how they would go through that process in Germany or in China. But I think that even if we don't know exactly how we can send those signals and how the other person's going to receive them, if we're attuned to the fact that we are, in fact, sending these signals and that this is part of the relationship building, we're already going to have a head start. Also, this is a reminder that in the previous lessons, I talked about how you're not just memorizing cultural information and then showing everybody that you know it. This is really where I think it's more important to interact with other people. I can show you that I want to have this relationship with you and I want to work well with you without necessarily knowing the entire history of the Netherlands, right? I can just try to send my own signals and I can try to be mindful of the fact that you could be trying as well. And maybe if I'm not sure exactly where things are going, if we're establishing a rapport, if my joke landed well, I can remember, oh, well, Zibe comes from a different culture. Maybe his signals are different. But if we can return to this idea that we're constantly either cultivating or undermining this fledgling relationship, we can try to get ourselves on the right track, look at the signals we're receiving in return and try to make modifications. It's not a formula that we can follow, but it's something to be aware of so that we can constantly try to be getting closer to the best chance possible that we have in working well with that person.
Yeah, I like it. Thank you for sharing that. We're talking today with Melissa Hahn, sharing her 10 lessons learned. Melissa is a successful author and intercultural professional, helping people collaborate, adapt, and thrive across cultures. I want to thank our affiliate partner, Audible. Audible is an amazing way to experience our program, 10 Lessons Learned, but also books and other podcasts, allowing you to build a library of knowledge all in one place. You can start your free 30-day trial by going to audibletrial.com/10lessonslearned. Again, that's audibletrial.com/10lessonslearned, all lowercase, to get your free 30-day subscription. Moving along, lesson number six, let yourself be ambivalent. I'm curious what you mean with that. That's being ambivalent, right?
Yes. So in the U.S., we often value things like being decisive, taking action, having clear-cut goals that we set, and then going out and achieving them. And that helps us accomplish a lot. It gives our life some clarity. The trouble is that, especially if we are going through a transition or we are in a new culture, we often just may not have that sense of exactly where we're even trying to go, let alone how we should try to get there. And I think sometimes when I work with my coaching clients, I see that they really are uncomfortable in that in-between space, which makes sense. If you're neither here nor there, where are you? But sometimes by trying to prematurely just hurry up and get to our destination, we miss out on the opportunity to ask ourselves important questions. And we also miss out on the opportunity to get a sense for what our options really are. So when I work with expats, I try to encourage them to not see this in-between stage as a problem to be solved, but rather as a natural part of their own journey and their own adaptation process that, of course, they don't want to stay in that forever. But allowing themselves to press pause and saying, I'm not sure what I think about this yet. I think I need more information. I think I need to go and do some experimenting. I think I need to do any number of things before I can actually get through this, can give themselves the space that they need to really work through it productively instead of rushing and possibly missing out on whatever it was that they could have learned.
Yeah, no, a good point. And I was thinking while you were talking about in so many countries, I want to say every country, but in so many countries, politics is an element that they talk about. And we don't have to talk about politics, believe me, that's not the purpose, but it does seem to affect people in different countries. And if a person comes in from a foreign country, well, does he or she understand what we are dealing with in our country, with our issues, etc.? And again, this happens all over the world, but that's an element that I think can be confusing as well, because it's one thing to learn about cultures and behaviors, but then there are other elements in there. And again, especially during an election year, politics, obviously, anywhere in any country are very important.
You know, maybe we could even say that being ambivalent is a good thing to be able to do in relationships. And I know that sounds surprising to people. Why would you want to be ambivalent in a relationship? But when you're meeting people, you don't know all of their opinions yet or everything that their whole life story. So the first thing you hear might not be the best indication of who that person really is. And just suspending our need to categorize them as in or out of our life, I think can be helpful. We can just let things play out instead of needing to take immediate action.
Yeah. If you have, let's say, the time for it in a conversation with people, of course, it works typically well to say, Melissa, tell me how you're doing and what's going on in your life, etc. But many times it's like, well, I'm calling you for a certain reason, or we're meeting for a certain purpose, and we don't hear the other story that perhaps keeps that person very busy in his or her mind. So there's more to it. I like the title for lesson number 7. Lesson number 7, let your light shine and help others shine their light too. That sounds really good, Melissa. I like what you're saying there, but what are your thoughts behind it?
My thoughts behind it come from my work, of course, Crossing Cultures. And there is a misconception that if we are going to work across cultures, we have to hide who we are. That in order for me to work successfully with you, I should mask everything American about me because you won't like that because you're not from here, for example. And I think that there are some understandable reasons that people make that assumption, just like your question earlier about, well, what if I'm in Japan? Well, then clearly I need to make some adaptation. But that's different from completely eliminating myself from the equation. And what Andy and I found when we were working on our book is that there are some questions you can ask yourself to try to determine maybe how free you are in a given situation to show your full personality. But we always make adaptations. If I'm working with a student, I'm going to be a little bit different than if I'm hanging out with my best friend, or I'm talking to a grandparent, or I'm interacting with a neighbor at the community meeting. There's always different sides of ourselves that we can bring to the table. But what we don't want to do is negate ourselves entirely, because that's going to be really demoralizing. It's going to be hard to sustain. It fuels resentment. But then other people are also going to be missing out on what we have to offer. By the same token, I think we want to be careful about not expecting people to remove themselves entirely from the relationship either. We want to invite people to bring what they have to offer, because otherwise, why would they be there? We want to really draw out people's potential and people's talents and people's stories and their backgrounds so that we fully benefit from everything that the people around us can contribute.
I'm thinking also, and it goes back a few decades, but I think it was Edward T. Hall that talked about low context and high context countries, where in certain countries, there's a lot of meaning derived from what's not being said, purely the behavior. Okay. And there are countries, including the United States, where, no, just speak your mind. And there are countries, including my native country, the Netherlands, where we will tell you what you should be saying. You know what I mean? Right? So the context sometimes is very direct, or it can be indirect. When you communicate with people, let's say from Asia, do you approach them differently than when you deal with people from Western Europe?
So what I find works is for me to not think about it as if I'm becoming a different person, but I think about how can I show them who Melissa is, but in a different way. So I, for example, being friendly and being approachable is important to me. I would find out how can I demonstrate that And I might demonstrate that to a Dutch person or a German person differently than I would demonstrate that to somebody in Korea or China. But I wouldn't remove that part of myself entirely. It would just be a different question of how do I allow them to see that in me, knowing that they might not be looking for that in the same way because they come from a different culture.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. I appreciate that. Lesson number 8, we're making progress here. Lesson number 8, prioritize taking care of yourself. How do you do that?
Well, it's tricky because one of the things I've learned is that nobody ever turns to you and says, gosh, would you like to go take care of yourself? Now is a good time to do that. But I think there is a cognitive and kind of emotional load of trying to work on all these different cultural dimensions. It's difficult to try to figure out, where do my colleagues come from? What's my background? How do I meet them where they are? How do we build these relationships together? And that's not even counting the actual work that you're doing, right? The work and the meetings and the projects, et cetera. So I think one thing is really important is to schedule the time that you're going to rest and recuperate. It doesn't have to literally be on your calendar, but to think about it as something to do that's just important as all of your other tasks. Now, you might not be able to achieve a perfect harmony between work and relaxation, but I think it's about recognizing that if you don't do this and that if you don't make arrangements to do that yourself, that you're going to start running on fumes and then you won't be able to achieve the goals that you've set for yourself because you'll be too tired. So I think trying to remember that all of this really does take work. Working across cultures can be fatiguing. And then knowing that you might need to accommodate your own self by having more time for rest. That's what my clients have had to do as well. Working in different countries, constantly being bombarded by different sort of stimuli and having to sort through it and make sense of it. It just wears you out more than it would being in your own culture. So deciding I'm going to take this day and I'm going to rest, or I'm going to go home every 6 months, or whatever it is that works for you, I think can really make a difference in allowing you to have a sustainable cross-cultural approach as opposed to just going full speed ahead until you crash.
Yeah, no, it's a wise lesson, but I have a hard time personally learning that lesson because it is indeed, well, if from the United States, if I talk to someone, let's say my friends in Australia with the podcast, that's right now an 18-hour time difference. When I deal with South America, it's 4 or 5 hours. When I deal with Europe, it's 8 or 9 hours. I'm so used to it, but I appreciate your point as far as you have to set limits. And you're absolutely right. When you are involved in international relations, communication, business, it's 24 hours, right? It's the globe. And I still find it difficult for myself to set limits, but I think it's a good lesson that, as you say, prioritize taking care of yourself, because it's easy to say, well, yeah, okay, I have to get up really early or I got to work late at night, but it's okay.
Sometimes we don't have a choice, right? Sometimes it's just the best thing. But I've started trying to let people know I'm on an earlier time or I'm in a different time zone than you are. And I'd say, oh, the time you propose is actually 5 a.m. for me. Do you have any wiggle room? Is there a way that we could possibly do this 1 or 2 hours later? And sometimes they can't. They're also trying to accommodate other time zones, maybe in Asia. But I've tried to give myself permission just to ask, to see if there's any possibility, rather than immediately trying to accommodate whatever the time frame is. Just asking can often open up possibilities.
Yeah, and maybe to plan ahead, right? To tell yourself, okay, next week or next month, I got to make sure, et cetera, that I allocate my time smarter than what I did last month, for example. So it's a good lesson, good to know. Let's move on to lesson number 9. When networking, think about making connections with people, not just obtaining business cards and sharing digital details. I love it. Your thoughts, please.
Well, this thought has two sides. One is for the people who are really confident and really able to just go up and shake hands and exchange business cards, but then later find out that they don't remember who they talked to. And it's also for the people who are afraid and hesitant to initiate those conversations. And I think for both sides of the spectrum, if you focus less on the task and you think more about, I'm just talking to a person, I think it becomes a lot more possible and a lot more manageable, but also a lot more meaningful. So at a conference, I can probably only keep track of, I don't know, a dozen or maybe two dozen people at most. I'm not going to remember everybody I met, and that's okay. But if there are people that you talk to that you really feel like you've initiated a connection with, it can help to think about those people, not just what they are and what their job, who they are and what their job title is, but something that you remember from your interaction. Maybe they mentioned that they came from a country that you want to go to, or maybe they mentioned that they too have kids, or that you both share a love of pasta over the banquet dinner. Whatever it is, if you can make a note to yourself about what you talked about, even the smallest thing, when you get home from that networking event, if you want to follow up with them, now you have a starting place. You have that little initial kind of seed that you've planted of this very fledgling rapport. It's not like you have a deep bond just because you exchanged this conversation, but it's a first step towards getting to know them as a person. Now, in truth, only a very small percentage of all those people, even if you follow this technique, are really going to be lasting connections. But the ones that do then become lasting relationships, I think, are even more valuable because you did give them the nourishment that they needed. So I think that for people who are just collecting as many business cards as they can, thinking about it in terms of relationships will help them slow down and make relationships that count. But also people who are afraid of the small talk moment, I think, can diffuse that fear by recognizing that you're not making brilliant conversation. You're just saying hello. Just say hello and just get started. And then pretty soon you will have a network that you can start to be proud of.
Yeah, I like it. It's in a way the softer side in the relationship. When people are dealing with issues and you meet them for a business meeting, but you find out that whatever, they have a child that needs to have a certain attention for whatever reason, is for that person at that moment the most important. And sure, we are here to talk business and whatever, negotiate something. But if you forget about the human side and the fact that person is at that moment, in my example, taking care of a child, that is at the top of that person's mind. And if you recognize that, chances are that person will say, I appreciate that you remember that you understand what I'm dealing with. And yes, let's talk about the business and we move on. But that relationship building, it's broader than just, like you say, exchanging business cards. So it's a very good example. Can you believe we're at lesson number 10, Melissa?
This has flown by, Zibe.
I know, and I wish we had more time. But lesson number 10, it is truly a small world. So guard your reputation and close doors gently, rather than burning bridges. Wow, good lesson, but tell me your thoughts, please.
Well, you can try to do everything right. You can think about the other person's culture. You can try to give space to their personality. You can be curious about them. You can build this relationship. You can really try hard, and things might not work out. People are difficult enough in our own culture. They can certainly be difficult to connect with when we're talking about other cultures. And I think we should accept that not every relationship is going to be permanent. Sometimes people just come and go, especially in business. But what I try to do is imagine that the people I'm working with today might know the people I'm working with tomorrow. And the reason I say that is that it's happened. My industries are very different: international relations, relocation, and even in higher education. And I am constantly surprised to see who actually knows who in these worlds that to me appeared very separate. And I've been grateful in retrospect to think, I'm really glad that maybe I just bit my tongue, or I just took the professional way out of that moment I had with that person, because I can now see that they're connected to somebody else that I know. And I wouldn't want a bad experience with one person to undermine a potential future opportunity with another person. So I don't think that means that we tiptoe. I think it just means that it's really good to remember in our connected world that we never know which people might know which other people. And so we want to be interacting with people in a way that reflects what we hope our character will be seen as by everybody, not just how we're feeling in the moment with that one person.
There are situations, perhaps, where you are not comfortable, not happy with what that person has decided and how it impacts you. Should you not push back, say something back, because he or she may be upset about the fact that you don't agree with them?
I don't think it's about agreeing. I think it's about deciding what your own style is going to be and trying to be consistent and have your own integrity. And of course, this is a personal as well as a cultural question. But if I, let's say I disagreed with you, Zibay, I might say, we could address that. I might say, oh, I think we disagree about this. Or I might say, I think that this project isn't working for us. I think I'm gonna stop working on this and I'm going to do something else. Like, you might have to have a conversation, and you might do that more or less directly, depending on your own background. But I think sometimes, I think what we want to imagine our relationships as part of a broader web of relationships. And so we want to be mindful that the way that we treat one person isn't just treating that person has dignity, we want to treat them that way, but also that they are connected to other people. So I don't think it's about being afraid. I think it's just about being conscientious and savvy about what our overall reputation is and what we become known for, really. So if you are having a conflict with a person, I think that's normal. You're not going to be on the same page all the time. But I think we want to be thinking about, there's no people who don't count. I think that's really what it's about. There's no people who don't count in our world. We want to be treating people with dignity.
And respect, right?
And respect, yes.
Because it's I look at it sometimes and I realize that I can be quite direct with people, but over time, I have learned lessons where indeed I need to say it a little bit more carefully, not because my mind says, this is ridiculous. No, that's not the way to solve the problem. And I think also sometimes when there is disagreement, to listen, to deliberately listen to the other person, even if you disagree, but it can be very helpful to let him or her speak their mind on a certain topic. Maybe there's something to learn. Maybe I still don't agree. But at least you give the respect. And I think that's what I see in your lesson as well, that, yeah, it is a small world in that sense. It's definitely a small world. It's a good lesson. Yeah.
If I could say one more thing, Zibay, it would be
Please.
That this is why I think the relationships matter over the performance. If you're focused on performing as if you're on the same page, and then you might feel that you have to mask how you really feel, or you might feel that you can't express yourself. If there's a relationship, even if we come from different cultures, I can say, you said that really directly, Zibay, or you might say, oh, Melissa, I might have come across really directly. Let's see if we can approach this in a different way. If you have the relationship, now you have the context in which you can be a more authentic version of yourself and in which you can constructively address places where things might have gone awry. If you're just trying to pretend that you're on the same page, that's really going to break down pretty quickly.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I had to think of a person I used to work for many years ago, and was crude. And in the office, he would refer to me as a bastard. At the same time, I learned so much from him. And it was his style, it was his personality. But I am so grateful that I worked for that person. And it goes back to your point, is that you have the respect. And even though the way he spoke, I don't speak that way, and I don't like to speak that way. But the person and the relationship that we had was very solid. And it's a great example of, indeed, we have to be, in that sense, gentle. Also, when people are crude and rude, if we can rise above it, don't let it affect us as individuals. Wow, that can be very helpful indeed. Well, let me ask you, and we have now covered your 10 lessons, but is there perhaps a lesson in life, in your career, that you would say you have unlearned, decided like, that's not the way to go anymore, I need to do it differently? Anything that comes to mind?
One of the lessons that I have unlearned is actually maybe counterintuitive for somebody who does intercultural work. And one of the lessons is worrying about being a perfect culture crosser or being a perfect expat. Before I went to Poland, I read all these things about all the things that irritate Europeans about Americans. And I tried really hard not to do any of them. And I still try not to do these things. I try not to talk really loud, or I try not to constantly chime into all the conversations if it's not called for. But I also found that what was written in advice books wasn't necessarily how real people on the ground thought about me. And I went to a conference one time. It was actually in Poland after I had been back in the US for a while. And there was a moment where I was in a small group discussion and nobody was saying anything. And everybody was just waiting. And finally, I couldn't take it anymore. As an American, I wanted to have this discussion. And so I said, well, I don't mean to be really American here, but I have something I can add. And one of the people said, oh, good, please go ahead. We don't know what we want to say yet. So they were happy, actually, to have somebody take the lead. So something that I had read in a book was something not to do was actually welcome in that context. So what I found was that we don't need to try to hide the fact that we come from a culture. Everybody in the room could tell I wasn't from Poland. And I spoke a little bit of Polish, but they could tell. So I think what I realized was that I could actually try to selectively share my American culture, not to try to make everybody else come to me, but it was still something I had to offer. It wasn't a deficit that I had to overcome. And I think the same thing comes from other cultures as well. One of my closest colleagues is Polish, and I always love the way she approaches her presentations and the way she works with clients. We've done some projects together because it's different from what I have to offer. And so if she was trying to be me, then I would miss out on having her be her. So I think something that I've stopped doing is trying to cover up the fact that I have a culture and just allowing it to be part of who I am.
Yeah, I like it. It makes me think, and that name comes up in my mind from time to time, Socrates, the Greek philosopher, 399 before Christ, so quite a while ago. But he talked about, as far as we know, about the concept. He said, I'm not from Athens. I'm not from Greece. I'm a citizen of the world. And like in your case, where you have extensive global experience and have lived in other countries, and you put these cultural aspects in the mixer and say, okay, like you just said, yes, I'm American, and I would say proud to be American. And well, people in Poland may have a certain impression of stereotypical Americans. And at the same time, we are who we are. And when you can cross bridges and communicate with people, it's not to say, well, because you talk to them, they became Americans. No, they are from, in this case, from Poland. And at the same time, I can see the curiosity to learn from you and your experience. As you indicated earlier, you learn from them and their experience. And that's being a global citizen in my mind. And it's a different story to talk about why people think that their culture, their country is the best. That's a whole discussion for a different time. But the idea is that there are different countries and different cultures and how to cross. And what you're talking about in your 10 lessons and definitely in your brand new book, I think that's something that hopefully people around the world can learn from. And I wish you a lot of good luck with your brand new book. And thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with our global audience.
Thank you, Zibe. It was a pleasure to be here.
In closing, I want to make a few remarks. You've been listening to our international program, 10 Lessons Learned. This episode is produced by Robert Hossery. And as always, we are supported by the Professional Development Forum. Our guest today is Melissa Hahn, sharing her 10 lessons learned. Melissa is an author and an intercultural professional who helps people collaborate, adapt, and thrive across cultures. And to our audience, don't forget to leave us a review or a comment. You can also email us at podcast@10lessonslearned.com. I hope you will subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And remember, this is a podcast that makes the world wiser and wiser, lesson by lesson. Thank you and stay safe.